Up to this point, I'd always thought of humanism as having its roots in the 18th century Enlightenment, and modern paganism as being an offspring of 19th century Romanticism. I knew that we were both committed to the ideals of humanism, but I was surprised to discover how many of our aspirations were held in common, and furthermore, how often our paths had crossed, diverged, and then recrossed more frequently than I had imagined over the course of two centuries, and often under the sheltering structure of the Unitarian religion. Later that year, our church's humanist committee sponsored a talk called Intersecting Circles by Conrad Hadlin, in which he quoted extensively from the works of Dr. Pat Duffy Hutchin, the much-published doyen of Canadian Unitarian Humanism, who is now, alas, of blessed memory. "We draw circles," Conrad said, "to define ourselves and our beliefs. Sometimes these circles can and should be expanded, and sometimes we need the wit to see the bigger picture, to generate creative new understandings about the real nature of whatever circles we might be in and who else might or might not be part of our circles. But where the faith community of the Unitarian religion happens is where these circles intersect." So far this morning, we've listened to a passage from Reverend Epperson's sermon and also to selections from two articles, one by Terry Eagleton from a recent issue of Harper's Magazine, and the other, the one about pagans and the starchy humanists, by Richard Wayne Lee of the Journal of Religious Humanism. The second article provided a comprehensive history of the events leading up to the present day, and here's a capsule summary. In the mid-19th century, being liberal Christians as well as fierce defenders of Enlightenment thinking, Unitarians declared reason to be the infallible test of belief. Faced, no surprise, with differing opinions about the reasonableness of particular elements of traditional religion, they responded by embracing individual freedom of belief and the acceptance of differing views. In 1894, Unitarianism issued a declaration against creed, and rational Christianity became no longer our unifying doctrine, but one option among many. From that time through the 20s and 30s, Unitarianism flourished. A quarter century later, in 1966, the Unitarian Universalist Association undertook an analysis of its combined membership. At that time, 53% of the respondents identified themselves as humanists. 44% defined God as, quote, "a natural process within the universe, such as love or creative evolution," while 30% deemed the concept of God either irrelevant or harmful. Only 3% professed belief in God as a supernatural being. That's the good news. The bad news was that coincident with the publication of this study, Unitarian membership in North America began a precipitous decline, falling from a high of 280,000 in 1967 to a low of 170,000 in 1982. Though the liberal Protestant denomination suffered severe membership losses over the same period, averaging 20%, Unitarians' staggering 40% decrease appeared to threaten extinction. But good news again, Unitarian membership subsequently bounced back, growing to 205,000 by 93. It still continues to increase at a modest rate during a period when liberal Protestant church populations in North America continue to decline. According to Lee's article, this recovery was due in large part to a growth strategy adopted by UU leaders in the 1980s, targeting the 60s generation and their children and opening Unitarianism to the countercultural values of this generation. These included direct experience and intuition over abstract reasoning, awareness of the true inner self, and the assumption that all life is united and all existence is one. These values find expression in a wide range of new religious movements that share a mystical theology of spiritual immanence, spiritual interdependence, and divine immanence. But in fact, Unitarianism actually assimilated only a particular set of related belief systems: American Zen, New Age, Native American spirituality, and neo-paganism, the latter including goddess spirituality and modern Wicca. Modern Wicca is what I am. So, what happened to the light of reason, the principles of the Enlightenment that have guided Unitarianism for 200 years and been official policy for over 100? Is our recent surge in population the result of a Faustian bargain that sold out our venerable humanist heritage in favor of a set of marginal populist belief systems that appear to fly in the face of rational principles? In my opinion, the answer is an unequivocal no. First, let me say that the argument between mysticism and rationality within the Unitarian Church is far from new. In 1832, Ralph Waldo Emerson resigned from the Unitarian ministry, complaining that the excessive emphasis on reason had turned it into a religion of dry bones and a thin porridge of pale negation. He did so as a leading transcendentalist, a system of visionary mysticism that considered an indwelling divinity as the guiding principle of human awareness. And transcendentalism was the first of many such 19th century spiritual movements that we now gather under the broad rubric of Romanticism. As Reverend Epperson described in his sermon, the Enlightenment was the dominant philosophy of the 18th century. It swept Europe from Descartes to Kant and was marked by an enthusiasm for progress, science, reason, secularism, and personal freedom. In contrast to the rationalism that marked the Enlightenment, 19th century Romanticism was more concerned with human feelings, and this was reflected in the rich emotional undercurrent of the poetry and music of the age, as well as the powerful visual symbolism of its paintings and sculpture. Any discussion of 19th century thinking must begin with at least a brief look at Romanticism's rich legacy of criticism of Enlightenment thought, including the perils of utopianism and universalism, the disregard for time-honored and traditional institutions and wisdom, and the secular tendencies of rationalism to suppress religious awe and reverence for the transcendent. The social thinkers of the Romantic era were strongly critical of the industrialization and urbanization of 19th century society, which we still share, right, Carl? Get them. And their writing was marked by passion and imagination. Much of this passion was focused on the apparent, and sometimes not so apparent, flaws in the rational paradigm. The Enlightenment gave the Western world separation of church and state, but it also set the stage for the Industrial Revolution and modern capitalist society. Individual freedom and self-determination were cherished values of the Enlightenment, but it's important to remember that these principles, along with a firm belief in justice and equality, are primary elements of the cult of the individual. From a political point of view, The Enlightenment can be seen not only as a body of ideas, but also as a militant ideology, the intellectual expression of capitalism in the ascendancy. For a more balanced assessment, we need to turn to writers like Jonathan Swift, who is both a product of the Enlightenment and one of its most vehement writers of critical satire. In the late 19th century, we find Karl Marx, a child of the Age of Reason, who also launched an implacable critique of it. In this respect, Marx's true successor was Sigmund Freud, whose work reminds us that in serving the cause of reason, we must keep faith with the irrational forces from which it springs. In fact, Swift, Marx, and Freud, along with later writers like Thomas Mann and John Muir, never fail to be conscious that unreason always lurks somewhere at the root of reason. It would seem that the rational method, in its inability to deal effectively with these underlying elements of irrationality, has an especially difficult time providing us with an effective model of morality beyond the utilitarian ethic of the marketplace. In their Tales of Faust, neither Marlowe nor Goethe take traditional religion very seriously, and therefore neither of their Fausts feel bound by traditional morality. But neither writer knew anything of Freud. They did not realize that the perceptions of the external world that inform our ethical systems operate beneath the conscious level, and that down there, even a towering intellect like Faust can still believe in the incredible, even in the disproven. In a recent issue of the New Yorker magazine, a writer reviewing two recent books on Leonardo, near the end of his article, stoops to comment briefly on Dan Brown's best-selling Page Turner. And I quote, "A cultural anthropologist 100 years from now will doubtless find in the unprecedented success of the Da Vinci Code during a time of supposed religious revival some clear sign that in the Elvis mode, what a lot of Americans mean by spirituality is simply an immense openness to occult superstition and misinformation of all kinds." End quote. In his Harper's article on the Enlightenment, Eagleton suggests that the more crassly materialistic modern life becomes, the more it gives rise to pseudo-spiritual claptrap. As social life grows increasingly two-dimensional, it grabs for some spurious sort of depth. The more ruthlessly rationalized the society, the more desperately irrational its members. The trick, I suppose, is for reason to acknowledge the power of the irrational, as the ancient Athenian state paid its due to the terrible powers of the gods, and in doing so sought to turn them to its advantage. But to acknowledge and make use of the irrational is not to surrender to it. Unitarian mystics believe that the divine permeates the universe, revealing itself in nature and in the human soul. The universe is characterized by a unity that we may experience directly by cultivating the proper sensitivities and sensibilities. But being Unitarian mystics, we value, even depend on, the power of the intellect to organize and communicate our principles. Furthermore, the role that the rational is capable of playing in the structuring of spiritual experience can make the difference between a fruitful and a failed mystical adventure. Mystical experiences and esoteric insight need to be grounded in core values, and these values are part of the outer, the rational, the intellectual structure of a religion. Since the mid-1960s, we've been increasingly surrounded by the wreckage of esoteric religious systems that have become disconnected from the structure of their exoteric value systems and have quickly devolved into venues for self-empowerment, self-forgiveness, and self-deification. So many of us who found a home in the Unitarian community are learning to appreciate the rational structure, the intellectual balance, and the humanist core values that have descended to us from the Enlightenment. But the question remains, what can we New Age mystics offer to those starchy humanists who so patiently nurtured this powerful tradition, apparently for our benefit, over the breadth of the last two centuries. First of all, we can make an effort not only to continually ground our work in these rational, intellectual, and ethical systems, but also to explain ourselves and our endeavors in terms that serve to improve communication, and not to drift off into the occult jargon of secret and hidden meanings. When I'm asked by my fellow Unitarians, as I often am, exactly what we pagans mean by magic, I say that magic as we practice it involves the intentional manipulation of powerful psychological symbols for the purpose of producing predictable and beneficial effects on the psyche of the practitioner. In his Intersecting Circles homily, Conrad Hadlin quotes Dr. Pat Duffy Hutchins as saying that humanist spirituality is a consequence of the development of symbolic language. It is the unique ability to manipulate symbols that make it possible for humanity to share experience as distinct from mere animal awareness of outside stimuli. Our human ability to manipulate ideas by the use of symbolic language has made it possible for us to create an entire world of ideals and artifacts, and to use imagination and memory and reason to pass these elements on from generation to generation. These spiritual products free us from the narrow limits of subjectivity, and often forcing a creative readjustment of our worldview. And this is what represents spirituality to Unitarian humanists. Interesting, intersecting circle indeed, very impressive. But even given these remarkable similarities of belief concerning the power of symbols, quite a variety of different constructs are possible. The pagan idea of the numinous as a countryside teeming with woodland deities and demi-deities, not to mention nymphs and dryads, stands in stark contrast to the humanist concept of nature as a metaphysical ultimate, the focus of a worldview without gods or animating spirits of any kind. But according to Conrad, most of the humanists connected with Unitarianism see themselves as religious humanists, a hyphenated category quite different from secular humanists. Secular humanists, he maintained, work to steer humanism away from any connection with religion whatsoever, implying that practices such as candle lighting, meeting in a building called a church, singing hymns, having pauses for silent meditation or musical meditation, etc., only serve to trivialize a gathering which for them is simply a time to define themselves as totally scientific and totally distinct from any sort of religious ritual which perhaps they feel they have outgrown and want no further part of. But, according to Richard Wayne Lee, the entry of mysticism into Unitarianism dominated by secular thinking, humanist thinking, is facilitated in three ways. First, as heirs to the mystical tradition established by the Transcendentalists, we inherited, both its legitimacy and its constituency. Second, they affirm the exceptional value of the person, upholding the authority of the individual and the acceptance of differing views. And finally, they embody a religiosity that seems entirely compatible with modern rationality. The persistence of mysticism within this reason-exalting movement suggests that the two may well be, in practice, entirely compatible with one another. Both humanism and mysticism invest the individual with considerable, if not final, authority in matters of belief. Furthermore, mysticism shares rationality's preference for empirically verifiable knowledge, and mysticism places the divine in a final and irrefutable way directly in the path of the inquiring and apprehending mind. Furthermore, I'd like to remind those mystics present that the age of reason was also the age of feeling. For every Voltaire, there was a Rousseau. If the 19th century was an era of utility and calculation, it was also the heyday of sentimentalism, with its interest in the inner light, inward experience, autobiography, and the search for authenticity. There was also a politically radical enlightenment that was firmly committed to the ideals of truth and freedom, but that drew conclusions from these ideas that are still deeply unwelcome by those in authority today. For nearly two centuries, Unitarianism has influenced North American culture in a manner greatly disproportionate to the number of its adherents. It has done so as the heir to these radical Enlightenment traditions, and also by adopting and nurturing a series of fledgling religious and social movements that, lacking its institutional haven, may have flown a far shorter distance or perhaps never taken wing at all. Reverend Epperson ended his sermon on the Enlightenment by expressing the belief that in this church, a shrine fed by the living roots of the Enlightenment, the holy is not absent. I would enlarge on this observation, encouraging us to seek a balance between mysticism and humanism so that the little altars everywhere of Unitarian New Agers and pagans, fed as they are by the living roots of Romanticism, continue to be structured and supported by the radical Enlightenment's commitment to reason, and in this place, both the holy and the rational, the esoteric and the intellectual, may feel right at home. Here endeth the lesson.